This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 269, of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the FanDuel Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. You can't be a good fantasy football analyst if you're stubborn. Sometimes it's really hard to not be stubborn, but it's a really important part of being an analyst of this game about a game. Because you're going to be wrong, and you're going to be wrong a lot. No matter how much logic and reasoning you use, things aren't always going to go your way. A lot of that has to do with things in football just constantly changing. I mean, a month and a half ago on this podcast, I noted that Deontay Foreman fit the criteria this season of being a breakout running back. And then Deontay Foreman was late to meetings and didn't seem to have his head in the game, so the Texans cut him. And so I changed the way that I viewed Deontay Foreman. Things change. The way teams view players, the way players perform, it's not some stagnant thing. So as an analyst, it does me no good to have a take in March of a given football season and not change that take when we have new information. Honestly, if I had one complaint about the way that humans consume stances that people have, and this goes far beyond fantasy football, but if I had one complaint about how humans consume takes, it's this idea that takes can't change. People hate when opinions change. But why? If you have new information and that new information points you in a different direction, then your opinion should change. We should actually applaud the politicians, the sports analysts, the scientists, the doctors, anyone who has a stance, they get new information, they see the stance was wrong, and they change their opinion. That's a good thing. And that's why I do this episode every year. I look back at an offseason of takes and opinions, and I see how those views have changed. I look at players who have risen in rankings and projections and players who have taken a dip. I won't cover every single player, but this is a way for us to all be on the same page and you guys to know where my head's at. It's a quick way to examine the fantasy football landscape and how it's changed. Before looking at some of those risers and fallers, though, I wanted to let you guys know about FanDuel's World Fantasy Football Championship. From September 5th through December 1st, you can enter a number of different qualifiers at different prize points over on FanDuel to earn a seat at the $2.5 million live final in Puerto Rico or the $3.5 million online championship. That's $6 million in prizes. For more info on the WFFC, visit FanDuel.com/WFFC or download the app today. Eligibility restrictions apply. So over the weekend, I got a few mailbag questions about Josh Gordon. So this feels like the perfect opportunity to talk about that whole situation and Gordon being reinstated. Because clearly, Josh Gordon is a riser. So first off, I'm amped that Josh Gordon is back. He makes the game better. But let's take a look at what this means from a fantasy football perspective. Last year, Gordon played more than 60% of New England's offensive snaps in 9 games. He had 2 weeks to sort of get acclimated to things, and then from week 6 through week 15, he was a regular starter in that New England offense. Over that time period, 18.5% of New England's pass attempts were directed at Gordon. He averaged almost 7 targets per game. And over this time period, Gordon ranked as a pretty firm wide receiver 2 in PPR points per game. What's even better is that in 3 games where Josh Gordon didn't play with Rob Gronkowski, he went for 100 yards on 7 targets, 130 yards and a touchdown on 9 targets, and 81 yards on 12 targets. During those games, Josh Gordon's target share was about 26%. So what we're looking at here, if Gordon plays all 16 games and he's good to go right away, we're looking at a locked-in wide receiver 2 in fantasy football. Now clearly, given Gordon's history, we can't just draft him in that Brandon Cooks range. We know there's risk that he won't play. So where exactly do you draft him then? It definitely depends on risk tolerance, but a case can be made that you could take him as early as the 5th round. And my guess is that his cost is going to fluctuate wildly from draft to draft. So it's one of those things where if you're in your draft and you feel like that you can take on that risk, then go for him earlier. If not, then don't. But do know that around that round 5 area and even into round 4, historically, that's been a place where your opportunity cost drops pretty significantly. So the cost in taking Josh Gordon there isn't that significant. And do know that Josh Gordon's upside is there. So I can't fault anyone for not wanting to take on Gordon, but the risk-reward is pretty strong in those middle rounds. Another riser this offseason, which really has happened over the last week or so, is Nick Chubb. Earlier in the offseason, I voiced my concerns about Chubb's receiving workload in the Browns offense. Not just because of Duke Johnson, but Jarvis Landry, Odell Beckham, David Njoku, there are plenty of mouths to feed in that Browns offense. It's not that Chubb can't be a pass catcher. It's that the ceiling there was a little bit capped. But Duke Johnson being gone helps that a good bit. at least until Kareem Hunt comes back. There's natural risk with Chubb given we don't know what that backfield's going to look like when Hunt is in the mix. But my projections like Chubb a good bit more after the Duke Johnson move. Because before it, he was basically at the bottom of that tier with James Conner, Le'Veon Bell, Dalvin Cook, and Joe Mixon. Now he's arguably at the top of it, and I'm talking about PPR formats here. I still like Dalvin Cook's upside a lot this year, but I can't fault anyone for drafting Nick Chubb ahead of any of those players. I've got him for over 50 targets now, which is necessary for that type of draft capital. Speaking of running backs rising with the departure of a pass-catching running back teammate, that's one hell of a transition. But speaking of those players, how about Kerryon Johnson? If you didn't hear my Players to Target episode a couple of weeks ago, then you missed me talking about Kerryon Johnson. My fear with him entering this offseason was twofold. First, he wouldn't see goal line rushes this year. What if that happened? Last season, he had only two, and the Lions got CJ Anderson. Anderson could realistically play the LeGarrette Blount role in that offense this year. Blount was the one who saw a lot of the goal line looks last year. It's still a question mark as to how Detroit will use Johnson when they're close to the goal line. But at least we know he'll have an even higher floor this season with Theo Riddick out. I do expect Detroit to be more run-heavy with offensive coordinator Daryl Bevel, but Johnson is still projected to see close to 80 targets in my projections. So if he does get goal line work, he's in a good spot to finish the season as an RB1. My projections actually have him right there with the other running backs that I just talked about, so he's got potential in 2019. The last high-end running back that I want to get to today is James Conner. I wasn't very bullish on Conner's fantasy outlook after the season ended last year. And the logic was as follows. The Steelers ran him into the ground, he got hurt, Jalen Samuels came in and he looked pretty good in relief, and despite the Steelers having a workhorse running back in recent history, the belief was that Samuels would dig into Conner's workload more this season than he did last year. It was a pretty logical take, especially after what happened last season. Now, I don't necessarily think that Samuels is a bad dart throw this year, but I've cooled off on the idea a bit. And it has a lot to do with what I've been reading from beat writers and what coaches seem to be saying about the backfield. The Athletic's Mark Cabali recently wrote that, quote, "The real question with Conner is whether he will get spelled from time to time by Jalen Samuels. It's not going to be as much as you might think, if at all." That's just one recent quote on that situation. I do think we should temper expectations if we're comparing Conner's workload this season to last season when he was healthy, but I'm bringing this up because I do still see Conner being in that same tier that I've now referenced about 45 times in this episode already. He's right there with Bell, Cook, Chubb, and Mixon. And Kerryon if you want to throw him there. I honestly don't have a problem with any of those players. You can make an argument for each of them, and you can also make an argument against each of them. But just know that I think that James Conner right now is right there with all of those guys. Let's roll right into the wide receiver situation for the Steelers, where we've got a battle for that number two job between Dante Moncrief and James Washington. Last month, I mentioned on the Spotting a Breakout wide receiver show that Dante Moncrief fits the mold better than James Washington does, mostly because he's had production throughout his career. Typically, breakout wide receivers don't just come from nowhere. Now, with that being said, James Washington has shown up in the preseason. And some of you may or may not remember, but I liked Washington a lot when he was entering the draft. My model did too. He had elite efficiency as a deep ball guy, and he was either average or above average in every market share category. Just for some context, my model had DJ Moore as the top wideout in the class by a wide margin last year. And then there was a tier with Calvin Ridley, Christian Kirk, and James Washington. And then the next tier was Kiki Coutee, Dante Pettis, and Anthony Miller. So let's take a step back for a second. I like James Washington, and the preseason has helped his draft stock, at least in my opinion. But Dante Moncrief looks to have the snap share in his favor. The talk in Pittsburgh all summer has been that he's the number two, and he played 9 of a possible 14 snaps with the starters in the Steelers' last preseason game. James Washington played 1. So it's a scenario where Moncrief will likely get more looks early in the season. But I do think that we should consider James Washington a riser from mid-July or so, given how he's performed in the preseason. Honestly, it's just fine to throw darts at both guys in your draft. And even throwing a dart at Deontay Johnson in a deeper format is fine too. It's not like you're having to pay a premium for these guys. And it's in an offense that can support a number two wide receiver. Another situation that's been up and down for really the entire offseason is the Chiefs' backfield, and Damian Williams in particular. My stance here has been fairly consistent, and I talked about it in some detail on last week's mailbag episode. But I do believe Kansas City wants Damian Williams to be their guy. Andy Reid said that directly in early July, and then Williams had his hamstring issues. That allowed Carlos Hyde to get some run with the ones, and in the preseason, Darwin Thompson has looked really strong. But Williams is playing with the ones, and that's what matters here. If he sees work in that offense, he's going to be productive in fantasy football. Now, I'd be lying if I said my projections didn't bump him down a little bit, just given what we've seen from Darwin Thompson, and considering he already sustained that hamstring injury. Damian Williams has already been hurt. I'm not really that concerned about Carlos Hyde, though. Carlos Hyde might not even make the team. But I do think that you have to be somewhat concerned about the fact that Williams has never carried the load throughout his career, and how that might affect his body. And as I mentioned last week, it's really hard to buy into him if you're drafting him over someone like Mike Evans. Like, I think Damian Williams is probably priced properly. But he's priced properly within his position. If you have to take him over Mike Evans, I wouldn't be taking him. But his ADP has fallen just a little bit over the last week, where he's now being drafted behind both Mike Evans and Kerryon Johnson. And I think that's fair. So while Williams is a faller, he's not a faller to the point of him being undraftable. And for the record, I do think that Darwin Thompson should be a late round priority. And I don't mean that from the perspective of him being a handcuff. I mean that as in he could carve out a more significant role as the season moves on. But at the very least, I'd be surprised if it's not mostly Damian Williams' backfield to start the year. Two very obvious fallers this offseason have been Melvin Gordon and Ezekiel Elliott. I've talked a good bit about their holdout situations on mailbag shows over the last month, and I'm still generally thinking the holdouts will end the same way as I talked about before. I'm more worried about Melvin Gordon than I am Ezekiel Elliott. Gordon needs to get to work around week 10 or so in order for his contract to not toll. But the Chargers don't seem like they care, probably because they have players in that backfield who can play. Both Austin Eckler and Justin Jackson are pretty good buys at their ADPs right now because of this holdout situation. But with Zeke, I'm still a believer that he's going to show up by week one. One of these sides are going to cave. And my money is still on Dallas caving because of the perception that they absolutely need Zeke. But let's talk about the guy who's rising like crazy because of the Zeke holdout, and that's Tony Pollard. It's such a strange situation with Pollard because he was like a slot receiver in college. And now he's Dallas's top running back. According to Establish the Run's Adam Levitan, Dak Prescott played 13 snaps during the last preseason game, and Tony Pollard was on the field for each of them. And it's crazy because Pollard only carried the ball 78 times last year in college. He was the third running back on that Memphis team. He had 139 total carries in college. There's some correlation between college workload and success at the NFL level. Good running backs generally were good running backs in college too. But we do have outliers. Alvin Kamara is a great example of an outlier. And that's sort of the player who the Cowboys think they have in Tony Pollard. Kamara had a sub 20% rushing share during his final collegiate season. Pollard's share was about 1.5 percentage points lower. But where both of them excelled was in the receiving column. Pollard had about a 15% reception share during his final season when Kamara's was a little bit under 17%. Both numbers ranked in the top 10 among all relevant running backs who have entered the NFL over the last three seasons. And both guys have a similar size profile. Kamara's a little bit more compact, but he's a bigger bodied running back than people realize at 215 pounds. Tony Pollard isn't that much different. So the comparisons are there to some degree. The main difference is that Kamara's path to relevancy in fantasy football was a lot easier to see than Tony Pollard's. Because if Zeke plays, it's hard to see Pollard being anything more than a flex play. Either that, or Zeke is going to take a huge hit performance-wise. And if that's the case, then why would they hypothetically pay Ezekiel Elliott? Now, if Zeke isn't on the field so they don't pay him, then Pollard is really intriguing. He won't see the type of workload that we get from Zeke, but the pass-catching potential is there, and he can be a 150-plus attempt guy. Maybe not a 200-attempt one, but it's not as though we've never seen a scenario like this before. Like I said, I still think that Zeke plays this year, but I also think that Tony Pollard should be on your radar as a late-round pick. Absolutely. And that's whether you get Zeke in your draft or you don't get him. Crazy things happen in the NFL every year. Pollard, though, is a major riser. I haven't talked about many wide receivers today, but Emmanuel Sanders is definitely someone on the rise because his body isn't normal and he's a freak of nature. He's coming off a torn Achilles and is apparently playing in the Broncos preseason game tonight. Now, I'm recording this on a Monday, so the game hasn't happened yet, just for the record. Now, I usually wait a year before drafting players coming off a torn Achilles, but Sanders is going so late in drafts that the risk-reward is absolutely there. I think he's a fine pick. And him playing hurts both Cortland Sutton and Deshaun Hamilton, specifically Hamilton. Hamilton took 63% of his snaps from the slot last season, which was a near identical rate as Emmanuel Sanders. When Sanders was healthy, though, about 42% of Hamilton's snaps came from the slot. That's all according to Pro Football Focus. But over the final four games without Emmanuel Sanders, that jumped to 74%. During those final four games, 24 of Hamilton's 37 targets came when he was lined up in the slot. About 60% of his receiving yards and one of his two touchdowns came from the slot. Basically, this just lowers Hamilton's overall ceiling. We know the slot is an area of the field for wide receivers to generate mismatches, and that can lead to more production. So having Sanders healthy will limit that opportunity for Deshaun Hamilton. So Emmanuel Sanders is a riser, while Deshaun Hamilton, and to some degree Cortland Sutton, is a faller. Now there are a couple of other situations that I wanted to briefly mention before letting you go today. Ito Smith, who I've brought up a few times this offseason, he has a chance to lose that number two job, so he's a faller. I'm actually taking some late round flyers on Brian Hill in that offense right now. And this Kenyon Drake injury has really helped Kalen Ballage become a riser. But I'll be honest, you guys, I'm really not into drafting a running back from that Miami offense. That's going to do it for today's show, though. Thanks to all of you for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are pretty much anywhere podcasts can be found. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, it's always helpful if you can leave a rating and review. You can follow me on Twitter at LateRoundQB. I'm tweeting all the time, and sometimes those tweets are helpful. Thanks, everyone. Talk to you later this week with the mailbag episode.